Okay, this is lecture number one. Lecture number one in our course on apologetics. I titled this course Apologetics 2, so that the earlier course, if anybody took that, that's Apologetics 1. It's not as in-depth. This is going to be much more in-depth than that course. We're going to talk on a lot of different aspects of apologetics that we did not touch on in the Apologetics 1. So I call this Apologetics 2. I was thinking about calling it Advanced Apologetics, but I don't consider this an Advanced Apologetics course. Advanced Apologetics course would probably get more into methodology, and there would be a lot more writing and that type of thing. So it's just Apologetics 2. If the first Apologetics was a first-year course, this is about a third-year course. Maybe even a second-year course, depending on how much curriculum there would be in the field of apologetics in a particular school. Of course, with Farriston and the Institute, we try to stress apologetics. The textbook, basically the primary textbook, there's three favorites that I have. You can pick one of the three. One is Christian Apologetics by Norman Geisler. Christian Apologetics by Norman Geisler. If you don't like abstract argumentation, if you tend more towards historical evidences for the Christian faith than you do philosophical argumentation, then don't get this one, because Geisler, the first one-third of the book is just trying to answer the question, how we find truth. What method should we use to find truth? The next one-third of the book says, okay, now that we have our method to find truth, which worldview is the correct worldview? You know, is it pantheism? Is it theism? Is it deism? Is it polytheism? And then the last one-third is historical apologetics. So Geisler basically, in the first two-thirds of the book, does what most apologetic authors do in their first chapter. So it's very, very abstract. I think it's, if not the best Christian apologetics text on the market, it's certainly one of them. Most Christian apologists, we just assume everybody knows that we can find truth, and we leave questions of how man finds truth, what philosophers would call questions of epistemology. We just ignore that aspect, and then we just assume that we do know truth. And I think that the time that Geisler spends on it really shows you that any non-Christian worldview has a real tough time justifying their knowledge of truth. Also, Scaling the Secular City by Dr. J.P. Moreland. We had Dr. Moreland up for our 1995 Defenders of the Faith Conference. How you doing, Lucky? We just got started, so
good.
So you've only lost, I think, 17 points at this point. No. I'll pass that back to him. But J.P. Moreland's book, Scaling the Secular City, A Defense of Christianity, also published by Baker Bookhouse, as was Geisler's Christian Apologetics. Really dynamite work. Moreland, for the most part, argues a lot like a clone of William Lane Craig on the areas where they build. If they have chapters that are similar, they almost argue in identical fashion. At the same time, there are some chapters in Moreland's work that are so unique, like the job that he does on arguing for the existence of the immaterial mind apart from the physical body. He has some work in this text that is extremely unique. So that's another really good textbook. William Lane Craig, Apologetics and Introduction, is out of print, but now they got it back in print and added another chapter by Craig Blomberg, and I don't remember the name of it. Does anybody remember the name of it? They changed the name. It used to be Apologetics and Introduction by William Lane Craig, and now I think it's something like Reasonable Faith or Faith and Reason, that type of thing. But William Lane Craig, I consider Craig, Geisler, and Moreland the three leading Christian defenders of the faith alive today. And I know there's a few guys at Notre Dame that would disagree with me, but I think as long as they throw Aquinas out the window in certain areas, that their arguments aren't going to be too difficult to refute. But I would say one of these three, if you chose one of these three as your textbook, that's fine. Now, you may choose to use a different textbook. For instance, here's an example by R.C. Sproul, John Gerstner, and Arthur Lindsley, Classical Apologetics, and it's subtitled The Rational Defense of the Christian Faith and a Critique of Presuppositional Apologetics. That's a real good book, though an awful lot of it is trying to critique Vantillian presuppositionalism. I would accept that as a text. But what I'm saying is, if you're going to use any textbook besides the three that I've shown you, Moreland, Geisler's, or Craig, talk to me first. If this was your first apologetics course, and you have Geisler's and Brooks, When Skeptics Ask, I would say I would probably let you use it. But if this is the second course in apologetics you're having, I'd say no, it's time to move on to something more meatier. Maybe go on to the next Geisler work, where he's more in depth there. But whatever the case, after a primary text, I'm going to recommend, and not demand, because it's impossible to get this book, actually, which is too bad. Ancient Evidence for the Life of Jesus by Gary R. Habermas. That went out of print, and they put it back in print, The Verdict of History. And then that went out of print, and now Dr. Habermas, just a phone call with him last week, told me that he signed a contract so that he's going to add 100 pages to it, and it's going to be republished. The problem is his wife just passed away, and so they allowed him to take about 5 or 6 months off, so it's not going to be out to like summer of 96. So, unfortunately, with the trials that are going on in his life right now, we won't be seeing this book in print for some time. So if you know an bookstore that deals with out-of-print books, is one that Gary could tell you about in Portland. Maybe they can get their hands on it. If not, we may have to wait on that. Now, He Walked Among Us by Josh McDowell is very similar to Habermas's Ancient Evidence for the Life of Jesus. The only difference between Josh McDowell and Habermas, they usually deal with the same exact evidence. It's just that Habermas, as a trained philosopher, knows how to present that evidence in the most airtight possible of an argument, whereas McDowell just likes to clump evidence after evidence and just leave it there and let you decide what to do with it. Which I'm not slamming McDowell, he's done a great work, but he just, as far as his argumentation isn't as strong as Habermas's is. But that's basically the textbook. So I would say just either Geisler's, Moreland's, or Craig's. And you might want to supplement it with a little bit of historical evidences, like either Josh McDowell's Evidence That Demands a Verdict, or if you can get your hands on The Verdict of History by Gary Habermas. Let me give you a brief overview of this class, some of the things I want to touch upon in this course. We're going to go over a basic intro, an introduction to apologetics, and the biblical basis of apologetics. And we're going to try to get through that today and spend two lectures on that. Next week, what I'd like to do is go over a real brief history of Christian apologetics. I think the best I'm going to be able to do is take eight of the greatest defenders of the faith in the history of the church. Augustine, Anselm, Aquinas, Bonaventure, Descartes, Pascal, Leibniz, and Paley, William Paley, and just give you a brief overview of those eight guys, and then show how the thought of Immanuel Kant, Hegel, Kierkegaard, Hume, and Nietzsche, how that kind of threw a monkey wrench into Christian apologetics. Well, what it did was all men in Western civilization agreed with the Western view of rationalism and the law of non-contradiction, and then all of a sudden that was chipped away. We believed in the idea of absolute truth. Once these guys came along and they threw that out the window, all of a sudden the apologists had to regroup and figure out how we're going to respond to this, because now it's just not taken for granted that there is such a thing as truth. And so now we end up in what has led to postmodernism, and we have to basically argue epistemologically. I'll give reasons as to how we can know what we know before we can even begin our arguments now. So it makes it a lot tougher. We're going to be talking about what I decided to do was not only go over the history of Christian apologetics, but go over some of the leading defenders of the faith from our generation. Some of them have went to be with the Lord not too long ago. But Gordon Clark, we're going to look at Gordon Clark. We're going to look at Cornelius Van Til, Norman Geisler, and Francis Schaeffer. I want to spend a little bit of time on those guys. Geisler, I want to give an overview of his textbook in the course. We're probably not going to spend more than a lecture, if even that, on it. But just to show you how a modern-day Thomist, a follower of the... He accepted the basic argumentation of Thomas Aquinas and argues along those lines. And so I want to just show you how a modern-day Thomistic evangelical argues and where he goes with his system of thought. But then we need to deal with the presuppositionalist Gordon Clark and Cornelius Van Til, those who don't argue to Christianity, they argue from Christianity. They start with the presupposition that the assumption that the God of the Bible does exist, and then they argue from that point. And Clark and Van Til, though they're both called presuppositionalists, they were the biggest, that they had more fights between those two than they did between what they call the evidentialists, what we would call traditional apologists, those who defend the faith, like Aquinas or Augustine, or people like that. Schaeffer was schooled by Van Til, and he presupposed the truth of Christianity. At the same time, he was willing to test his presuppositions as well as testing the presuppositions of non-Christians. And so we'll take a look at that, and we'll try to basically develop our own apologetic methodologies as we go on. I'm not going to force you to be a Geislerite or to be Augustinian or to be Thomistic or to be Van Tilian. However, it will affect your grade where you end up in it. We're going to want to talk about the failure of atheism. The failure of atheism. We're going to go over some of the big atheistic arguments and show why they failed to disprove God's existence. We're going to talk a little bit about creation science, some scientific evidence for the God of the Bible. We're going to talk about philosophical arguments for God's existence, so that the theistic arguments or evidences for God. We'll discuss Old Testament and New Testament reliability. The Old Testament reliability, we'll spend most of that time refuting the documentary hypothesis, the idea that there was more than one author for the first five books of Moses and that type of thing. New Testament reliability, we'll give evidences for the New Testament as being reliable and written by the traditional authors during the traditional dates, the conservative dates that are given. We'll try to answer the question, is Jesus God? Oops, I skipped a few there. Actually, first we want to discuss, did Jesus rise? Because if you can prove that he rose from the dead, then it makes your case that he's God a lot easier. Did Jesus rise? Is Jesus God? By the way, it follows my basic argument for biblical Christianity. And I wouldn't... Your apologetics, your defense of the faith needs to be personalized. I had one brother who loves the Lord and everything, but he spent the whole ferry ride on the way to Seattle presenting evidences for God's existence to a Muslim. Well, the Muslim already believes that God exists. He should have been presenting historical evidences for Jesus rising from the dead or dying on the cross, because the Muslim rejects both of those. So you want to start with where the person is. If they accept the existence of God, but they reject that Jesus is God, then you want to start with historical apologetics. If they reject God's existence, but they accept the idea of absolute truth, then you can start with arguments for God's existence. But if they reject absolute truth, you have to start your argumentation arguing that there are some things that are true and there are some things that are false, regardless of how a person feels about it. So you have to start where the person is. But basically, we're going to go over in the last lecture in this course, I'll just outline one argument, my whole argument for Christianity, which basically starts with that the arguments to this attempts to disprove God's existence have failed. There is good evidence for God's existence. There is good evidence that the New Testament is a reliable historical document. There is good evidence that Jesus rose from the dead, that Jesus is God. I just basically, at a certain point through in these lectures, about one third through these lectures, we're basically giving a lot of details for one big argument for the Christian faith. But how you apply that one big argument, whether you just need certain aspects of it or the whole entire thing to a particular person, is going to depend on what type of person it is and what their views are. So, is Jesus God? We're also going to want to answer the question, is the Bible God's Word? Is the Bible God's Word? We're going to have to discuss briefly moral values. Is there such a thing as right and wrong, and how can we prove it to those who disagree? We'll discuss different world views other than theism and atheism, and why these different world views are false. And then we'll give you my final argument, which is just basically a summary of the course, defense of Christianity. So that's what we're going to want to look at throughout this course. I don't know how many lectures. I'd like to get this done in about 24 lectures. I don't know, two a night for 12 weeks. I don't know exactly how long it's going to last. I don't want to rush it, though. I want it to be as conversational as possible. If you have questions, feel free to ask them, and so we could attempt to gain as much understanding in this field as possible at this level. Okay, if you look at your handouts, the biblical basis for apologetics, actually it's an introduction, and the final portion of the first page deals with the biblical basis for apologetics. So we're going to start our introduction, and we need to answer the question first, what is apologetics? What is apologetics? If you look at 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15, this is where we get the word apologetics from. 1 Peter chapter 3. And verse 15. And the Apostle Peter says this, "But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence." So we are to be gentle with others, and we're to respect their views, and respect their right to hold those views, because God gave them free will. At the same time, we are to always be ready to make a defense. Now, the word there for defense is apologia in the Greek. I've heard it pronounced a lot of times apologia. But from what little I know of Greek, I believe it's supposed to be pronounced apologia. And we get our word apologetics from it. So, basically, apologetics defined is simply the defense of the Christian faith, the intellectual defense of the Christian faith. Now, there's a lot of different ways that you can intellectually defend the Christian faith. So I don't want to give you the idea that there's only one way to do it. When we talk about the different apologists at a later time in these lectures, we're going to see that there's a lot of different styles, a lot of different methodologies. But basically, there's seven types of methodologies. This is the way I summarize them. My doctoral dissertation that I'm completing at this time, this is the breakdown that I gave, and I was questioning whether I should have added an eighth one or not, and I decided that it was so close to traditional apologetics that I decided not to. Now, the first type is philosophical apologetics. Philosophical apologetics basically just deals with philosophical argumentation in defense of the Christian faith. In other words, we're arguing for God, evidence for God's existence. We're trying to explain the problem of evil, how an all-good, all-powerful God could coexist with evil and human suffering. We're trying to make sense out of God talk or religious talk, religious language, talk about God. How can a finite man talk about the infinite God? All those things would come under the heading of philosophical apologetics, basically what we call philosophy of religion. Now what I've done is I've broken down what is usually called traditional apologetics or evidentialism into philosophical and historical. Most of the time when you hear of evidentialist, it's usually somebody that uses either philosophical or historical apologetics, or he uses both, either one or the other or both. And I decided that there's enough there to put them in two different classifications, so that, you know, the traditional apologists like Geisler, Moreland, Craig, they use both philosophical and historical, and then I would even argue they even use scientific apologetics as well. And Geisler has even gotten into comparative religious apologetics. But philosophical, you're using your reasoning and arguing for the existence of God and that type of thing. Kind of the theistic proofs, the arguments for God's existence and the attempted refutation of the atheist argument against God from evil. The second type is historical apologetics, is basically historical evidences for presenting historical evidences for the truth of Christianity, arguing that the Old Testament is reliable and the New Testament is reliable, and arguing that the Bible is God's word, that Jesus did die on the cross for our sins, that he did rise from the dead, that Jesus is God. Historical evidences for the Christian faith. By the way, Geisler's work is two-thirds, his apologetic work, apologetics, or Christian apologetics, is two-thirds philosophical and one-third historical, whereas most works done by traditional apologists are usually one chapter philosophical and 11 chapters historical, that type of thing, that type of breakdown. And so, though Geisler does both, he's heavier on the philosophical aspects. Dr. Gary Habermas, my professor at Liberty University, he's almost exclusively historical evidences. Same with Josh McDowell. Although Josh McDowell will present, we'll get into comparative religious apologetics as well. Scientific apologetics, you see people right out of California, Dr. Henry Morris and Dr. Dwayne Gish are two young Earth creation scientists, whereas Hugh Ross, also out of Southern California, is an older creation scientist. But using scientific evidences in an attempt to prove the existence of the God of the Bible. Comparative religious apologetics, I would say probably the biggest name that comes to mind from our generation is the late Dr. Walter Martin, with his epic work, The Kingdom of the Cults. He was the world's foremost authority on non-Christian cults. And comparative religious apologetics is not the same as comparative religions. A course in comparative religions it basically tries to teach you how to see the particular religions you're studying from the mindset of the people within them. So you're just learning about it. You're not really, the main stress of the course, though it might touch on it, is not to refute it. Whereas in comparative religious apologetics, the emphasis, you present the basic beliefs and then you refute them. But the emphasis is on the refutation of non-Christian religious groups. Presuppositional apologetics. The more I learn about presuppositionalism, the harder it is for me to pin it down and understand it. It is, for the most part, presuppositionalists will normally, not always, I'm finding a lot of guys who classify themselves as presuppositionalists that don't mind traditional apologists that much anymore. But it used to be, if you were a presuppositionalist, even Gary Habermas told me he had Greg Bonson speak at Liberty University and spent about a week over his house. But for the most part, a presuppositionalist says that it's mockery to argue for God's existence. It's a slap in the face of God, and it's a bold, arrogant proclamation of a human's autonomous reason. In other words, as you're saying, it makes it, a person's is basically putting their own reason on the throne and saying that my reason is going to determine whether or not God exists or not. And they almost make it sound like the traditional apologist is acting like it's because of our reason that God exists. He exists because we reason that he does exist. And as if our reason brought him into existence. But that's not exactly what they're getting at. But they do act like we give the unsaved man too much credit when we act like there's common ground between us and them so that we can argue for the truth of Christianity. Now, even saying that, Bonson would put a footnote there on what I just said, whereas Gordon Clark would say there is no common ground. Yeah, Jeff?
What effect does Calvinism have on the presupposition as full of the fact that we are under capacity?
Okay. I would answer your question and say it usually has a great effect. At the same time, we do have like that book by Sproul, Lindsley, and Gerstner. They are Calvinists who are Thomists. So they are traditional apologists, and they're trying to refute Cornelius Van Til, who's a presuppositionalist and who is a Calvinist. Gordon Clark is a presuppositionalist who is a Calvinist. Plantinga is a Calvinist, and he's because he holds to God as a basic belief, which is basically a presupposition, he's probably some type of presuppositionist. Ronald Nash is a presuppositionalist that's a lot closer to traditional apologetics, but he's still a presuppositionalist. Although the way Ronald Nash defines his presuppositionalism, I think I'd be defined as a presuppositionalist. But what I'm getting at is, if Calvin is right, and if man is so totally depraved that our reason, I do not believe our reason is fallen in the Calvinistic sense, but to be honest with you, I don't even believe our will has fallen in the Calvinistic sense. Because in the Calvinistic sense, our will is so fallen we can't even freely accept Christ. So it's a tough question to answer, but I'll just put it to you this way. In order, in the Calvinist, in a strict five-point Calvinist sense, in order for a person to get saved, he doesn't freely choose to accept Christ. God zaps him. God regenerates him totally apart from the guy's will, and then once the guy's regenerated, then he freely accepts Christ because he has a new nature. Now, given that soteriological view, that view of salvation, given that, what would that do to a person's apologetics if they applied that? Now, Clark and Van Til tried to argue that Calvin did apologetics like them, but he didn't. Calvin did apologetics a lot like Thomas Aquinas did. But I think that Calvin was being inconsistent. I think Van Til and Clark were being more consistent, being presuppositionalist. And in other words, until God regenerates you, you will not presuppose the existence of God, and no arguing is going to get you to that point. Now, while you're arguing with a person, God might decide to zap them, regenerate them, but that's God's will, God's sovereign will, not ours. So I would say that though I agree with Sproul, Gerstner, and Lindsley, three Calvinists who are Thomists in their apologetics, although I would not classify myself as a Thomist, I have tremendous respect for Aquinas, but on epistemological issues, I'm somewhere between him and Augustine. Though I agree with Sproul, Lindsley, and Gerstner that we should use evidences to try to prove God's existence and the truth of Christianity to others, and that they're not, rather than presuppose it, at the same time, I think if they were more consistent with their Calvinism, I think they would be followers of Gordon Clark or Van Tillian, somewhere along those lines. And by the way, Clark and Van Til are presuppositionalists, but they don't agree on just about, there's hardly anything they agree on. So presuppositionalism is a term that we use to cover a lot of guys who just don't fit into the definition of a traditional apologist. But for the most part, what they're arguing is that there is no common ground between believers and non-believers, the Van Tillian, it's real easy because I have heard a lot of people, even students of John Frame, who was a student of Van Til, argue that Van Til taught that in Romans 1, because man's reason is fallen, he doesn't see God proven in nature. But in actuality, that's not what Van Til. Van Til actually taught, no, Paul's right, man does know that God exists from Romans 1, it's just he's lying through his teeth. He suppresses the truth. So basically, in Van Til's thought, the atheist is an outright liar, whereas in Gordon Clark's thought, the revelation is there, but it just doesn't get through because man is so fallen. So I would say, you know, there's a wide divergence of views among presuppositionalists, and it's real tough to pin them down. I would favor Van Til on that particular point. Yeah.
So what you're saying, the presuppositionalist doesn't question whether God exists, and they don't even argue it. It just jumps out and expects the other person to always believe that.
Yeah, it's kind of like this. It's not that he expects, Van Til expects the person deep down to believe it, even though he might have deceived the hardest, tremendously deceitful, like Jeremiah says. He might have deceived himself. Bonson, a Van Til clone out of Southern California, sometimes I think he's better than Van Til philosophically, because Van Til had a lot of contradictions, which I just don't hear in Bonson. But Bonson's whole PhD dissertation, Doctor of Philosophy in Philosophy in USC, was based on self-deception, how we deceive ourselves. And one of the biggest areas where he sees us deceiving ourselves is that even though God, just looking at a flower, just looking at the stars at night, just looking at another human being, cries out to us God is crying out to us at the top of his lungs, I exist, I exist, I exist. Yet, we suppress that truth and lie to ourselves and tell ourselves that he doesn't exist, because wouldn't this be a nicer place to live if I was the king? And if I didn't have to bend the knee and worship God. So we lie to ourselves, even to the point, I bet you if Bonson and Van Til would both say that an atheist will probably pass a lie detector test if he says there is no God. Yet, they would both say, deep down inside, he knows there's a God. But the easiest person to lie to, and I think Bonson could probably prove this better than anybody, the easiest person to lie to is ourselves. You know? We can be a lousy baseball player, and everybody in the world can know that, but we can convince ourselves that there's, you know, it's just the wind was blowing when that ball was hit to us, and we could explain away 14 errors in a half hour as if we were Mickey Mantle or something. But basically, you got the what's called the evidentialist. Which is basically the traditional apologist. And then you got the presuppositionalist. And then on the other side, this is both to go out and I ran out of room, you have the fideist. I used to say that the way you can break them down, now I'm finding out that from the Van Tilian school of thought, that there was a lot of people misrepresenting Van Til. I hope Bonson never hears me say this, because that guy actually is bad when it comes to debates. But Van Til, I told Moreland that I thought Gordon Clark was sharp, but I thought Van Til was a babbler. Moreland told me he agrees. Okay, but there was a lot of things that I thought were very contradictory in Van Til's thought, and that in his, I thought that in his, and people catching his contradictions, rather than admit that he made a blunder, he would come up with some complex system to try to explain away the apparent contradictions, and then he just got and so he just got deeper and deeper in a lot of mumbo jumbo. I mean, this is a guy, Van Til is a guy who said God is one person, but he is three persons. Now, if that doesn't violate the law of non-contradiction, what does? Then he also taught that the law of non-contradiction, that God is beyond that. Well, if God is beyond it, then if ultimate reality is beyond the law of non-contradiction, then the Buddhists are right when they say God exists, but God does not exist. Now, I don't hear any of that coming from Bonson. So it sounds to me like Bonson has perfected or at least improved the Van Tilian system, and he came up with some dynamite stuff. But what I'm finding out, I used to say that evidentialists will both refute and defend. Evidentialists will refute error and defend the truth, and positively defend the truth. They'll give evidences for God. Whereas presuppositionalists wouldn't defend the truth, but they will refute others. And they are believing. If you want to find out how to tear down somebody else's belief system, read the presuppositionalists. Gordon Clark believed God is logic. God is right thinking, so from God's nature flows the law of non-contradiction. So he used the law of non-contradiction to tear down everybody else's belief system. Now, Van Til thought that the law of non-contradiction was beyond God, but he thought just for humans to reason, they have to assume it. So he still used the law of non-contradiction like Clark did to tear down people's views. So they would refute but not defend, but then the fideists do neither. The fideists, they just accept their belief by a leap of blind faith, and they don't defend their views, and they don't refute others. They say you just have to believe. Now, the problem is, though, now I'm finding that Van Til was not only willing to refute, but he's also willing to present positive evidences for the Christian faith, defend, i.e. the transcendental argument for the existence of the God of the Bible. We'll get into that when we talk about Van Til. And now we've got a lot of guys like Ronald Nash and probably Plantinga who call themselves presuppositionalists, who are not only refuting the other views of others, but are also defending the Christian position. So it's tougher to pin it down, but all I will say is this: the presuppositionalist, I think the presuppositionalist is on to a better understanding of man and the way he thinks than a lot of current traditional apologists, and that we can learn a lot from them. At the same time, I think they underestimate Aquinas and Augustine if they assume that Aquinas and Augustine didn't think the same way that they thought. See, what they basically... Some evidentialists, probably John Warwick Montgomery was one of the worst at this. Why is that deacon? Bummer. It's like a beep the whole time. Yeah, don't even worry about it. If we got to listen to a beep, I'd rather that than have the thing explode on us. Oh, battery. Yeah, that's a bummer. Anyway, what was I talking about now?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. See, they basically say that, John Warwick Montgomery would act like if he can prove that Jesus rose from the dead, he's proven that Jesus is God, that God exists, everything, you know, stuff like that. But as Geisler points out, facts do not, historical events do not come with their own built-in interpretation. And instead, we usually interpret the facts by our worldview rather than adding all these facts together and then coming up with a worldview. Yeah.
That's the point I was going to ask you. You keep on bringing up epistemology, but it's really your ontology that governs your metaphysics, because it galvanizes the inner fundamental for presupposition.
Well, all I would say, though, is in most contexts, ontology is metaphysics. So, because ontology and metaphysics are both the study of reality, that which is. So, the question is, it's like Gordon Clark said. Gordon Clark said, we have to decide, maybe we can put something over that to muffle it.
You've got
the
access code, don't you?
Yeah.
You can turn it off. But you've got to have the access code to do it.
Hold on one second. Yeah, getting back to what you were saying, Gordon Clark pointed out, a lot of times people slam Gordon Clark for being an idealist, that he thinks that reality is ultimately ideas, and that he denies the existence of the physical world. And Clark said, I never said that. And then they bring up all quotes that made him sound like an idealist, and Clark said, well, see, the problem with you guys is you're thinking that I'm talking metaphysically. All my writings deal with epistemology, with how man knows. In other words, Gordon Clark never even got to his metaphysical views. He spent all his time just questioning how man knows that there's a desk in front of him. And he's horribly brutal in debates. He would debate scientists who couldn't even give him a definition of matter. You know, he would ask people to define every term that they came in. Even if they gave him a definition, he'd say, are you aware that there are several leading physicists who disagree with that definition? So what he's basically saying is that the world's leading greatest minds don't even know what matter is. How are they going to tell you that there's no God? The thrust of a lot of what he did, a lot of his work, was the fact that we just ignore the whole epistemological question, how does man know, or can man know, and then we just get right into arguing our different views. And so, but the presuppositionalists, what they try to tell us is that a man's presuppositions will determine how he interprets a fact, rather than the facts determining what his presupposition or his worldview is going to be. Yeah, all men are biased. It's exactly right. All men are biased. But now there's a whole bunch of presuppositionalists that are coming on the scene admitting that, but then saying, however, enough of those facts, or maybe sometimes just one little fact, may trigger, as Ronald Nash says in Faith and Reason, may trigger something we know that we, some truth that we know that we've suppressed, and some fact may trigger it and bring it out of the unconscious realm into the conscious realm, and it might become our new presupposition in life. And the thing is, I don't consider that a lot of people call that, Gordon Lewis calls that the verificational method of apologetics, but I think it's just a good solid type of traditional apologetics, and I think we're assuming too much to assume that Aquinas wouldn't hold a similar view if those questions were being asked during his day. I don't think Aquinas would have he believed we started life as a blank slate, but he didn't believe that we come into these, you know, examine nature and things totally neutral. I think Aquinas would have agreed that we come into life biased. I mean, that not that we come into life biased, but by the time we reach adulthood, we have our own biases and presuppositions, and the question comes up whose presuppositions are true. Even Aquinas would argue that we have to have certain presuppositions that are in agreement with others, and they would be what he would call the first principles of knowledge. But we'll get to that when we talk about Aquinas and others and all. But there isn't that. Just basically, the presupposition deals with you presuppose God and argue from Him, rather than saying to the non-believer, okay, let's pretend we know nothing and then just build our case up and argue for God. Well, I really don't think any traditional apologist really does that, but that seems to be the claim of the presupposition. But actually, I see the presuppositional camp and the, at least the Vantillian presuppositional camp and the traditional apologist, the evidentialist camp, moving closer and closer. Yeah.
What school is Rosa Parks?